I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. With the weekend upon us, we'll be talking barbecue in the second hour of today's show with three master grillers who can answer all your burning questions about backyard smoking and grilling. Up front, a look at legal wrangling in the case of the Freddie Gray Six. Rona Cabell of the Bay Journal has the lowdown on Governor Hogan's shakeup at the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We'll get the weekly business report from Rick Seltzer of the BBJ. Plus, librarian Paula Gallagher has three summer reading suggestions, including a book on the Beanie Baby bubble. And Christopher Llewellyn Reed tells us what to catch and what to skip at the movies this weekend. Midday Friday starts after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here for a Midday Friday and a busy one for you. In our second hour today, after the news at 1 o'clock, we're talking barbecue with master grillers from our area. Pitmaster and author George Hensler will be returning to the show to give us some tips on grilling and smoking in the backyard. We'll meet another barbecue competitor, Jen McGrath, as well. And a local grilling ace, Greg Burley. He's from the Big Bad Wolf's House of Barbecue in Hamilton. And at the top of the second hour today, a Triple Crown preview with Charles Walker of the Sun. The Belmont Stakes is tomorrow in New York. Of course, the big question is, can American Pharoah, winner of the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, become the first Triple Crown winner since 1978? Big question. We'll talk to Charles in about an hour from now. Later in this hour, we'll get some summer book recommendations from Baltimore County librarian Paula Gallagher. And Midday critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed reviews three films for us. Plus, Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal has the weekly business report, including his story today about Governor Hogan being very bullish now on maglev, the high-speed maglev train. We'll talk about that when Rick gets here. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal analyzes some important staff shakeups at the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. Up first, though, Professor David Gray of the University of Maryland School of Law joining us again to talk about the state's case against the six Baltimore police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray. David Gray, no relation to Freddie Gray, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's good to be here.
There's been some news this past week and some speculation about the trial of the Freddie Gray Six. State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby is seeking a gag order to prevent the defense attorneys, the attorneys for the police officers, from speaking out, talking to the press. So I want to ask you about that first, David. Is a gag order typical in a high-profile case like this?
So I actually have a bet with a Baltimore Sun reporter on this as to whether the gag order ultimately would be granted. So I'm a little bit biased in my view, but as I understand it, the gag order was originally filed in the district court, and so that motion was mooted by the removal of the case from the district court to the circuit court. But as you know, State's Attorney Mosby recently filed or declared her intention to file a motion for a protective order, which would limit public access to some of the documents and evidence that would be part of the Freddie Gray prosecution, and presumably she might renew her gag order as part of that overall protective order. And my view is that these gag orders are, these requests for gag orders are par for the course in a lot of criminal cases. Prosecutors are forced to fight with one hand behind their back in a certain respect because defense attorneys are free to make public statements. And as a matter of professionalism, prosecutors generally don't and shouldn't. And that's one of the things that's impressed me about State's Attorney Mosby is that generally she's kept her statements about this case to court filings and hasn't been making a lot of public statements. But that can be frustrating for prosecutors when they defense attorneys are out in public and prosecutors don't have the opportunity to respond to state public statements that are made. So these kind of gag orders are not uncommon, but that dynamic is also common to criminal practice. And so usually gag orders aren't filed, but the bet that I have running with the Baltimore Sun reporter is based on his experience that gag orders are routinely granted in Baltimore. district and circuit courts. So we'll see who owes who a drink at the end of this. But my view is that a gag order probably wouldn't be granted.
Another development, sort of related, that Marilyn Mosby wants to prevent, you alluded to this, she wants to prevent the autopsy of Freddie Gray and other documents from being released. That's part of that protective order, I guess. She also broke with what we found out was a typical procedure for the prosecutor, not giving the a copy of the autopsy report to the police. So I wonder if you'd comment on that.
So it's certainly understandable that she would break with the usual practice of giving autopsy reports to the police, given that police officers are defendants in this case. So it's an unusual circumstance and probably deserves at least taking, at least considering whether that normal practice should be abided in this case. As to the motion for protective order or the promised motion for protective order, this is, as everybody knows, a very high-profile case, and there's a lot of public interest in the case. But there also is a pending motion for removal of the case from the Baltimore Circuit Court to another circuit court. And so it's not unreasonable that State's Attorney Mosby would want to keep some of the most important evidence out of the public so that when it comes to a potential jury selection, there's a chance that at least some of the potential jurors wouldn't have seen or thought about some of the most critical evidence. If all that evidence is out in the public in a very high-profile case like this, it becomes very difficult to select jurors who haven't already been exposed to some of the most important evidence. And so I imagine that that's going to be the basis for the protective order. And it's not an unreasonable request, but it butts up right against very important First Amendment interests. And so, for example, the Baltimore Sun and a group of others have filed amici briefs arguing against that, the possibility of a motion for a protective order. And so that's we'll see how that all plays out. But I can understand the reasoning of the state's attorneys for pursuing this protective order. But again, in my judgment, it's the sort of thing that would only be granted in pretty extraordinary circumstances.
Under such a protective order, if there were one, only the prosecutors and defense attorneys would be able to see those documents, including the autopsy report, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, so this relates to my next question.
Defense attorneys would have access to the discovery.
Of course. Yeah. Right. So this relates to my next question, what you were just saying about prejudicing potential jurors. The six officers' attorneys have filed for a change of venue from Baltimore, arguing that that their clients can't get a fair and impartial trial in the city. So let's talk about that a little bit, David. First of all, what do you think of the merits of that argument, given all that's happened so far? And is there any special criteria that a judge, where a judge would make a decision based on?
So the standards for removal are actually pretty liberal under the Maryland rule. So one party simply has to state under oath that they believe or have reason to believe that they can't get a fair and impartial trial. In this case, the Eighth Circuit in Baltimore. And then the court where the motion is filed has to satisfy itself that that suggestion is true or there is at least reasonable ground for it. And under that pretty liberal standard, it seems to me there is reasonable ground to believe that it would be hard to impanel an impartial jury in Baltimore. So that leaves a couple of options. One, the judge could simply offer the possibility of a bench trial rather than a jury trial. And that's something that defense attorneys might take seriously as an option in a case like this. Alternatively, the judge might simply find that the best course is to try to impanel a jury. And if it turns out that it is impossible to impanel a fair and impartial jury, then reconsider the motion for removal to another circuit. Or the judge could just look at the environment and say, there's too much going on. This case has gained too much attention inside the city of Baltimore. So I'll just go ahead and grant the motion, in which case it would go to the circuit administrative judge to decide which circuit court the case would go to. And it would be normal in those circumstances for the circuit administrative judge to take the advice of counsel in the case. But it would ultimately be up to him to try to find a circuit where there could be a fair and impartial jury.
David, on that question of a bench trial versus a jury trial, is that something the defense could request, or does a judge have to offer a bench trial?
So the judge doesn't have to offer a bench trial. The right to a jury trial at this stage belongs solely to a defendant. Mm-hmm. And in this case, since there is significant prison time at stake, there's a constitutional right to a jury trial in this case. But the defense could just waive that right and proceed in front of a judge in a bench trial. That's its option just about at any time in the course of the proceedings. And given the high stakes nature of the case and all the publicity it's had, that they might prefer to try this case in front of the judge, but that's not a decision that they would want to be forced to make right now. So it's perfectly reasonable for them to move for a change of venue, and depending on how things develop later on, then decide whether or not they want to have a bench trial or a jury trial.
Do judges, in particular administrative judges, have any special criteria for determining where to move a trial to if it is removed from this circuit? Is it based on voter registration, racial composition of a community, for instance?
Well, the circuit administrative judge has to make an assessment as to whether it would be reasonably possible to find a fair and impartial jury in the circuit where he is sending the case. And so I'm sure that he would consider a number of factors, in this case, physical proximity to Baltimore City. He would probably consult with the circuit administrative judges in other circuits to get their views and ultimately try to settle on a circuit that where he thinks that a fair and impartial jury could be impaneled. But the Maryland rules provide for multiple motions for removal. So if the parties get to another circuit and find out that there's good grounds for them to believe that they can't find a fair and impartial jury there, then they could file a new motion for removal and it would start all over again.
Hmm. And does the circuit to which a case is moved have to accept the case, have to accept the trial?
So certainly, but that's unlikely to be an issue. So I'm sure that Judge Pearson would consult with his colleague at the other circuit where he's thinking about sending the case to make sure that his colleague feels that that circuit could handle the case and they could find a fair and impartial jury. So, and if his peer circuit administrative judge says, no way, we don't want it, we don't think we can find a jury here, then I doubt very much he would force the issue.
Hmm. David, thanks again for being with us.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me, and I hope you have a good afternoon.
Yeah, thank you, David. David Gray from the University of Maryland School of Law, who joins us from time to time to talk about this case and others. We'll have to take a break here, a short break, our first break in the Midday Friday show. When we come back, more with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal and Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal will be joining us, and we'll take a look at what Governor Hogan had to say about maglev trains, and also find out what Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is doing to find summer jobs for kids here in Baltimore. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here now with Rona Cabell, who joins us once a month for Midday on the Bay from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, joining us on this Friday to talk about what happened a week ago, last Friday. Rona, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
A staff shakeup at the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. What
right.
happened?
So four people were let go last week at the Department of Natural Resources. The Deputy Secretary, Frank Dawson, the Fisheries Director, Tom O'Connell, the Communications Director, Darlene Pisani, and the person in charge of the Land Acquisition and Open Space, Kristen Saunders.
Okay. And the significance of this, because staff changes happen when new governors come into office.
That's right. Staff changes happen. Communications directors are often the first to go because the governor wants to put in someone who can talk about his message. Assistant secretaries and deputy secretaries are also often on the chopping block because the governor wants his own leadership team. The fisheries director was the one that was a little perplexing. It's not unprecedented. Ehrlich got rid of his fisheries director, Eric Schwab, who was very much beloved and had worked his way up from a police officer position, I believe, with the department. Mm-hmm. But the difference with Tom O'Connell, who is this fisheries director, is that Tom was extremely popular with the various constituencies who deal with fisheries, and that would be recreational, environmental, conservation, and many of the watermen. Not all the watermen, but many of the watermen did support him, and he worked tirelessly to make sure that decisions were made fair and equitably and based on science. So many of us knew that this was possibly coming, but it still seemed a bit surprising when it actually happened.
Governor Hogan had made statements about the O'Malley administration's war on watermen. I believe that's the actual quote, right?
Right. That was in The Sun. And what that's about is that Governor O'Malley started to take large areas of the Chesapeake Bay and have them off limits to oyster harvesting and instead put them in sanctuaries. The way it used to work is that sanctuaries were essentially whatever was left over, whatever the watermen didn't want to harvest. And consequently, they were poor bars, they had over siltation and sedimentation, and it wasn't that easy to grow oysters on them. But they started to invest many millions of dollars in rehabilitating our oyster population, which is at basically 1% of historic levels. So they took large areas of the Eastern Shore and said you couldn't harvest anymore. I think about 25% of the waterway. And watermen understandably didn't like this. They didn't like the fact that they were losing their areas. They didn't like the way the DNR was revitalizing the beds using shell that they had bought from Florida that was kind of this fossilized and ground up shell. And they generally were very unhappy. And the O'Malley administration was not real receptive to their concerns. And the Hogan administration seems like it's been much more receptive.
What part of that were they least happy about?
I think they were not happy about having the bars restricted from their harvest. But they're also not happy because the way that they're rehabilitating these bars means that if they eventually are open again to harvest, it'll be a little bit harder to harvest them with the gear they use because of the different kinds of shell. They're not using the substrate that we're used to seeing. It's different. So they're worried about their future, and they're worried about not being able to get those oysters now. And they also say that if you leave the oysters in sanctuaries and you don't harvest them, eventually those oysters will die because the bottom needs to be worked. That's what the watermen say.
Now, you found out today that actually the president of the Watermen's Association reported to his membership that a promise was made about these changes.
Right. He put that in his president's podium that
this is an online newsletter, right?
It's a print newspaper, and it was online also that the promises were made to the Watermen's Association about staff changes at DNR. And as of the writing of his column, those changes hadn't occurred yet, but they did occur in the delay between it hitting the streets and him writing it. Right.
And so, last Friday, because this happened a week ago, right?
Right. So this was the first print indication that we had where the Watermen's Association president stated that promises were made. We've, of course, been hearing that the Watermen's Association leadership was very unhappy. The Sun, Tim Wheeler's story talked about that they were unhappy with the changes that had been made under O'Malley, and they were hoping that Larry Hogan would be more receptive to their concerns.
Specifically when it came to oyster management, right?
Right. And that's why, as I said before, it is somewhat common to get rid of some of your top people. But another change that occurred is Mike Naylor, who is the person who managed the Oyster Sanctuary program, was moved to a job within DNR that doesn't have anything to do with oysters. And by all accounts, the sanctuary program under Mike Naylor was really successful. I mean, I've heard from scientists not within DNR, from University of Maryland, and even from Virginia, you know, wow, look at what Maryland is doing with those oyster sanctuaries. And it was a marked change over what we had seen before. And it happened to be coupled with an excellent spat set with the oysters from 2011 and 2012. So the restoration.
So there were improvements.
There were improvements.
And fairly quickly.
Fairly quickly. But again, ephemeral. We don't know that next year and the year after we'll continue to see oyster improvements because so much has to do with what's been harvested and what's with the weather. But the sanctuaries were something that you actually could control. You could manage those to grow your oysters. And when you have oysters reproducing and oysters in sanctuaries being left alone, those oysters proliferate throughout the whole bay, so not just in the sanctuaries.
So what does this foreshadow, can we say? I mean, what changes might there be with new leadership
Well, Dan, one thing that I think is really interesting is Hogan had 6 months to mull these changes, and we all sort of assumed that he wouldn't get rid of people during the legislative session. But what's interesting to me is he got rid of these people, and then he put in acting people. So he knew that he wanted to get rid of them. He didn't necessarily know who he wants to replace them. So what I'm thinking is that there's a lot of political discussions going on at the State House about who can step into these jobs. And what I'm interested in knowing is the new director of fisheries going to be able to control their staff, or is that going to be controlled by the State House? And are these decisions going to be made based on science, or are they going to be made based on quote-unquote stakeholders, which is what Secretary Mark Belton said in his email, is that we will be looking to stakeholders. And stakeholders means a lot of people, but it also means watermen.
Right. Thank you, Rona. Rona Cabell also had a story in the Bay Journal this week about the Baltimore Harbor. Let's switch to that topic. How is the Baltimore Harbor doing?
Well, better news than for the people who lost their jobs at DNR. The Baltimore Harbor is improving, and not markedly, but there are a few bright spots. The Gwynns Falls got a passing grade for the first time since they started doing this work in 2012. And one of the reasons for that is Baltimore County invested in a wetlands project along the Gwynns Falls using the stormwater money. The dreaded rain tax actually seems to have done some good here. So they used funding for the stormwater to restore these wetlands. And the Gwynns Falls, which is always been a fetid, trash-strewn, not very good quality waterway, improved a lot. And I think that's significant, that we have to remember with the harbor, there's such a long way to go. So when we see even, you know, a 20-point improvement over 2 years,
that's a pretty short period of time.
It's a pretty short period of time. And I think, you know, one of the big successes here is not just the numbers, but the awareness. I'm planning on going kayaking in a couple weeks on the Inner Harbor. Every week there are people kayaking, paddleboarding, out there recreating. And I think there's this understanding here and in other cities, too, that we shouldn't just write off these waterways because they're polluted. They're here. Let's use them. And maybe if more people use them, there'll be this greater awareness that, hey, we really need to get rid of, you know, the trash and the debris and the chemicals, you know, that are in them.
Well, there's the Healthy Harbor Initiative. There's Blue Water Baltimore, other groups all working on this goal of making it fishable and swimmable by a certain date. I forget what that was. Was it 2020?
2020.
Okay. Did the report card say anything about meeting that goal since it's 2015 now?
They haven't really said anything concrete other than, you know, they feel that it's unlikely they're going to meet their goal. But, you know, one of the other things that's kind of cool is the Baltimore Trash Wheel has gotten all this attention for getting
the trash wheel, sure. Yeah.
Right,
for getting solar powered trash wheel.
Mr. Trash Wheel apparently has a huge following on Twitter.
He does.
So the good news that they announced yesterday is they're working on getting two more trash wheels. One will be in Canton, and the other one is going to be over by the Raven Stadium. And they're not officially, they don't officially have them. They're still raising the money. But, you know, trash is a huge problem in the Inner Harbor, and it's a pollution issue, but it's also an aesthetic issue, more probably so than that, than the pollution is the way it looks and the way we regard the harbor. So I do think that, you know, even if you and I aren't jumping into the harbor in 2020, and I'm just crazy enough to probably do it even if it doesn't make the list, I think we're getting somewhere, and it's actually happening maybe even a little bit more quickly than some of us expected.
And still in the pipeline, pardon the pun, are improvements to the sewage system, the stormwater system in Baltimore City, and more improvements, hopefully, with the use of the stormwater remediation money.
Right. And this is a huge problem because we have a major infrastructure issue in Baltimore with these old pipes. And so while we don't have a combined sewage overflow system like they have in Washington, D.C. and in Chicago, we have this other problem of leaky pipes. And when we get rain, and we've had more rain last year than in previous years, 10 inches more, we're starting to see the cracks in the system, and millions of gallons of sewage can overflow in just one storm system. So that's the big nut that we have to crack. And the Department of Public Works in Baltimore said yesterday they are committed to cracking it.
Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. You can see Rona's story, find a link to it, the one about the DNR changes and also the one on Healthy Harbor or the harbor at ChesapeakeBayJournal.com.
Yeah, BayJournal.com.
I always do this. It's just BayJournal.com. Or go to my Facebook page. You'll find it there. Thank you very much, Rona.
Thank you very much.
We turn now to Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal for the weekly business report here on Midday. Rick, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, too. Thanks, Dan.
There's a photograph at the BBJ of Governor Hogan and his wife on a train in Japan, right? He's pretty. They look both kind of excited about this train. This is a magnetic levitation train.
That's right. It's a fancy new train, although you may have been hearing about rumors of this project for, I think, well over 10 years now. Basically, the governor's on a 12-day trade trip to Asia. He's in Japan right now, and he recently rode a 27-mile maglev in Japan. The governor is
How long did that take, do you know?
I do not know exactly how long that took.
Like 5 minutes?
I know that these maglevs, though, can go well over 300 miles an hour. This particular train he was on, I think, can go up to 375 is what I saw.
Okay. Somebody in the control room do the math for me. How far did you say he went?
27 miles.
So how long did it take him to go 27 miles at top speed? Go ahead. We got an intern in there working on it. Go
Great.
Ahead, Rick. I'm kidding.
So, but the going along with this, the governor also threw a little bit of weight behind the idea of a maglev between D.C. and Baltimore. Signed a agreement of cooperation, excuse me, a memorandum of cooperation, that there will be a collaboration between Maryland's government and the Japanese government working on some technology. Probably more notable, though, the state also submitted an application to the federal government, the FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration, for $27.8 million in funding that could go to things like studying, engineering work, that kind of work on a private proposal to put in a maglev line between D.C. and Baltimore.
Keyword private, because all along there, well, there's a group that's actually formed that's very bullish on this, that's mostly private interest, right?
That's right, although there are several ex-politicians who are members of it, including Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a former New Jersey governor, Senator Tom Daschle, actually, and Under Armour's own Kevin Plank, who's, of course, we couldn't have a project, danger project in Baltimore without his name
Kevin
on it.
Kevin Plank, yeah.
But yeah, it's something that's been around for a while. They've applied to the state for a railroad license, an old railroad license that would run between Washington and Baltimore. And ultimately, the idea is to make the trip between the two cities in as fast as 15 minutes.
You know, the question I have almost immediately is the red line and the purple line. You know, those projects here in Maryland are still on the governor's desk, and they're being studied further to assess the cost of them. So the next question would be, okay, if you're bullish on maglev, Governor, where are you on red and purple?
That's right. And I have not heard anything new on those two train projects, those two light rail projects. We'll have to see what happens with this. I think that the public and private distinction is very important here, because one of the governor's sticking points has been the price, particularly of the red line. You know, this maglev has a high price tag. $10 billion was the most recent number I saw. But we're talking about a private group. I think the Japanese government has been reported to have committed half of that money towards it.
Right.
So how much the state is actually on the hook for is very different. The state, as far as I know, has not committed any funding to the maglev.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake of Baltimore reported this week that she wants to fund 8,000 summer jobs for kids in Baltimore and has money to pay for about 7,000 of them, right?
That's right. Money to pay for about 7,000, which is a pretty significant expansion from previous years. Last year, I think they did about 5,600. Mm-hmm. The trick, though, is they actually don't have positions open, places to have these people work. Right. They only have places right now for about 6,000. So there's a big call for both more money to fund 1,000 more job positions to bring it up to 8,000. That would be about $1.5 million they're looking for there. And then also a big call for companies and other employers to step up and say, hey, we have positions for young people to work. These are 14 to 21-year-olds we're talking about. Work for five weeks over the summer and pitch in.
There's been a lot of talk about this, especially since the riots of Baltimore. And you've been writing stories about efforts to get those businesses that were affected by, damaged by, in the riots of April 27th back on track. The Small Business Administration getting a little more aggressive in its outreach to these businesses.
That's right. There have been a lot of calls in the last couple of weeks to get more people in the SBA's doors. That administration set up a couple of local branch offices here in Baltimore. As of the beginning of the week, they'd said they'd met with about 100 people. Now, that doesn't mean that all 100 are going to apply. That doesn't mean that all 100 are separate businesses either. 380 businesses or more were damaged in the riots. So there's a lot of outreach that's still going on. And there's a number of different loans that are available through the SBA. Rebuilding loans, Some are targeted at homeowners, but mostly at businesses right now as their outreach. Some low-interest loans for physical damage. You can buy equipment that was damaged, things like of that nature. Low interest, but there's a deadline that's coming pretty quickly. I have to have those in by July 10th. There are some other loans. There's a lot of things out there. So different groups, different organizations, different politicians asking, come in, and we'll try to guide you to what works for you.
Rick Seltzer of the Baltimore Business Journal, thank you very much for this report again, Rick. And Rick brought us the print edition of the BBJ, which is out today. The cover story is about Annapolis. Interesting. The historic state capital wants to woo the foreign tourists. Its D.C. neighbor is so good at getting. Interesting story. So thank you very much for that, Rick.
Absolutely. A little bit of tourism for the summer season.
Yep. All right. That's Rick Seltzer from the BBJ. We're going to take another break here when we come back. Three good reads for the summer from librarian Paula Gallagher, including one book on the feminist roots of the board game Monopoly. Can you believe that? And also we'll hear from our film critic, Christopher Llewellyn Reed, hear what he has to say about the new disaster flick, San Andreas. So please stay with us.
San Francisco will get hit again, and it's going to be a bigger monster this time. Our models are predicting a 9.5 or greater. It will be so big that even though it's happening here in California, you will feel
it. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Whether you're looking for a book to take on vacation or trying to escape just the rainy weather over the weekend, I guess it's going to be some thunderstorms over the weekend. Anyway, Baltimore County librarian Paula Gallagher is back with us, and she has three recommendations from the nonfiction shelf. Paula, nice to see you again.
Great to see you too, Dan.
And go to town on this, because all three of these sound great to me, and I hadn't heard of any of these until you sent me your list yesterday. So go ahead. The first one is called The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game.
Dan, I found this fascinating because so many of us grew up playing Monopoly. The board game has been around for a very long time. And there's common knowledge, or at least people think it's the common knowledge, that this game was invented during the Great Depression by a guy who was unemployed, lived in Pennsylvania,
down on
his luck.
That's a story we always heard.
Yeah, and he made a fortune, sold it to Parker Brothers, and his life was good.
Yeah.
But in fact, this game goes back, actually, decades. It started out in the early 1900s, and the reporter who wrote this book, Mary Pillen, is a sports reporter for the New York Times, and she really found this fantastic story, meatier than you could imagine and more fascinating than you could imagine. It actually, before she takes you back to this feminist who started the board game, she takes you to the 1970s, the early 70s, and she talks about this guy who was an economics professor at San Francisco State. And he was dismayed that people loved Monopoly because the term isn't a warm and fuzzy term.
No.
And right, so people have the wrong idea. You know, his students had the wrong idea of what a Monopoly was because they thought, hey, it's a great thing. We love the game.
Yeah.
So his idea was to create a board game that showed the bad side of Monopoly. So okay. He came up with a game called the Anti-Monopoly Game. And so then what happened was, you know, one thing led to another. Parker Brothers got wind. They were not happy. And he started this odyssey of lawsuits with Parker Brothers trying to keep his game. So basically, in his research, he found out that this game was invented in the early 1900s by this woman who was a feminist. And she was an economist herself or had interest in politics and economy.
Her name was Lizzie. Is it Maggie or Maggie? M-A-G-I-E is the
M-A-G-I-E.
Last name.
I'm not certain of the spelling,
okay.
But I'm going to say Maggie. Yeah. So she created a game called The Landlord's Game. And this game was intended to demonstrate the evils of land grabbing and the idea that if you were going to pay taxes, you shouldn't own land in the first place, but if you did, you should pay taxes on it.
So the game actually started off as something progressives liked. And then it turned out to be a game that capitalists really liked, right?
The game has such an evolution. It was embraced by left-wingers.
Yeah.
Then it became big in fraternity houses. And then from there, it ended up in Atlantic City. Originally, properties, as it adapted, this was not a printed game. People would draw it out on oilcloth. They would paint the squares, and each people would do some of their own things to it. But these wealthy Quakers in Atlantic City who owned hotels, this is an interesting story in itself, and it brings in some stuff from Boardwalk Empire. They brought all the Atlantic City real estate names to it. And
Wealthy Quakers.
You would not think, would you?
You wouldn't think. I like this story because it finally gives credit to Lizzie Maggie, M-A-G-I-E, for inventing the game. All right, now, the next book. The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute. I love this title.
If that doesn't get you, nothing will. If that doesn't get you, the cover is done in multicolor letters, typeface, with the Thai signature Beanie Baby on the cover. So yes, it's a giveaway of what this book is about. You know, if you lived in the 90s, guaranteed that you owned at least one Beanie Baby or your kids owned them.
Oh, yeah. Got a whole trunk full of them in the basement. Yeah.
Many people do, or they're in plastic cases waiting to be valuable again.
Yeah.
Some people let their kids play with them. Some said hands off, because they're going to be worth something. And so that's what the author, Zach Bissonnette, decided to take a look at. Well, how did this all happen? How did this get started? And how did people ever think that a plush animal was something to sink your savings into?
Originally, it was like $5, right?
Yes. It was originally intended $5, which was the starter of this company, Ty Warner, thought that that was the perfect pocket money amount that a kid might be willing to spend, or a parent for a kid,
impulsive,
on this animal.
Impulsive buy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But these were animals that were untraditional, Dan. These were not the big, cuddly, stuffed animals that were floppy. And gift shop owners didn't know what to make of them at first. But this guy was such a cult of personality that he was able to really sweet talk and force his way into so many shops and gift stores. And, you know, things started to take off.
You call this a compulsively interesting read.
It absolutely is. It's a soap opera. If you like, you know, if you like reality TV and you like intrigue and you have an interest in economics, psychology, it all comes into play in this book. Just fascinating.
The Dark Side of Cute. Okay, and the third book that Paula Gallagher wishes to recommend, by Michael Rosen, is called Alphabetical: How Every Letter Tells a Story. And you say this is not a children's book about the alphabet.
No, not at all. I like to refer to it as an ABC book for literary-minded grown-ups who love language. Hmm. This one, you know, I know we're talking about summer, but this would also make a great Father's Day gift if you're looking for that, because it's the kind of book that you'll want to have to go back to. You're not necessarily going to read it cover to cover because it's more academic. But again, just really interesting if you're somebody who likes language, who is into grammar and spelling. And of course, you know that I'm into those things. So
Scrabble. I've been playing a lot of Scrabble lately.
This absolutely would be a book that you would enjoy. So Michael Rosen naturally, of course, breaks it into 26 chapters, one for each letter.
Hmm.
There's a little prologue to each letter talking about how the letter itself was formed and the uppercase and the lowercase. And then he gets into some essays somehow related to that letter. He uses it as a starting point. So it's not all about the letter C. In fact, when he talks about the letter C, he talks about ciphers, and he talks about the roots of modern-day coding and encryption.
Hmm.
So that becomes a different story unto itself.
So all three of these books you really like, and this one in particular, I think, because of language. You love language.
Oh,
you're literary-minded, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that really I was interested in gets into spelling and how spelling from the 16th to the 20th century was really under discussion.
You know, all three of these books sort of lend themselves to full-fledged midday treatment, I think. These are the types of books that we welcome on whose authors we welcome on our show.
I think they would be great
so,
guests.
Yeah, thank you very much. Paula Gallagher, who's a Baltimore County librarian and joins us from time to time to make book recommendations. You can find all three of those recommendations on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, along with Paula's comments. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
Now we turn to film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair of the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University, part of our Midday on Film team with Linda DeLibro, here to review three films. Chris, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Dan, as always. So we know summer is here because we've got our dumb comedies, our sequels, and TV show adaptations, and, of course, disaster films.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to San Andreas just from that little clip I heard. But we're going to start with Entourage.
We can start with Entourage.
It doesn't matter. Which one are we starting with?
Entourage is good.
Entourage, is that the TV adaptation?
That's right. It opened on Wednesday, had a midweek opening, probably so it wouldn't compete with Spy, which opened today.
That's another film that Chris will be reviewing.
And Entourage is an adaptation of the long-running HBO series. Well, not an adaptation, a continuation. The feature film to follow the final eighth season in 2011. 11. I stopped watching the film, the show after five seasons. I'd sort of had enough. It was a guilty pleasure, and then it sort of became a guilty bore as we followed Vincent Chase, movie star Vincent Chase, and his buddies as they're living it up. There's a deep current of misogyny that runs through the show as they treat women as expendable sex objects. And although there are occasional female characters who rise above this two-dimensional narrative that is so often given, it's really about the boys. And in this film, the boys are back in town. And I have to say that, you know, if you ever enjoyed anything about the series, despite, you know, these misgivings and these reservations one might have, I think the film is kind of a sort of a better episode from one of those seasons that I watched. So it's certainly...
Is it the same cast?
It's exactly the same cast, and it features Jeremy Piven as Ari Gold, who was always my favorite character on the show. It's a career-making role for him. He won a number of Emmys, and this is really, in some ways, his movie as much as it is the movie about the boys. So the clip I chose tells us everything that the movie's about. We meet Vinnie Chase after a nine-day marriage that's gone bust on his yacht in Ibiza, and Ari Gold, whose wife made him stop being an agent because it was destroying their marriage, has nevertheless gone back to work as a studio head. And here he is. He's in Italy talking to Vinny on his yacht in Ibiza. So they're both on the phone as they set up what's going to be the plot of the film.
Vinny Chase.
Ari Gold.
Vegas odds had your retirement lasting longer than my marriage.
Well, good thing that I bet big against both.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. And you? How'd you get the wife to let you go back to work?
Once she realized that she couldn't understand what the Real Housewives of Milan were saying, she begged to go.
Ari, I'm not going back to work, Vinny.
I'm going back to be the king of Hollywood, but I agreed to live by all of my queen's rules.
Good. I hear you got something for me.
Something big. My first movie is studio head, and boom, I want you to star in it.
Oh, yeah? How badly?
What do you mean?
Because I decided whatever I do next, I also want to direct.
Does he even know how to direct?
Ari? All right.
So you picked a good clip there.
So you can hear the problem as it's set up. Yeah. Here's a movie star who wants to direct his first feature. Yeah. Ari's neck is on the line. And, of course, by the end of the film, everything gets worked out, but not quite as the characters intended.
That's Entourage. Now, Melissa McCarthy is back. Spy.
Yes, she is. And, you know, I have very mixed feelings about Melissa McCarthy. I was always a big fan of her on the TV show Gilmore Girls. And then she had a show where she was in a leading role, Mike and Molly, or co-leading role. But then she really hit it big with the 2011 film Bridesmaids, where she was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. And that film was directed by Paul Feig, who also directed her in The Heat opposite Sandra Bullock, and in this film, Spy. And recently she's had some films where I felt she was taking her sort of vulgar shtick a little too far, movies like Tammy, movies like Identity Thief. But then in the fall I saw her in a wonderful film, St. Vincent, opposite Bill Murray, where she toned it down. Now, granted, she was in a supporting role again, but here she's in a leading role, and she's toned down just enough for me while still being that highly energetic, kinetic force that so many of her fans love. So she plays a CIA desk-bound analyst who, you know, the outdated maxim behind every great man is a great woman. Well, the film opens with her literally directing every move of the James Bond-like superstar, super spy played by Jude Law. She's at her desk with satellite views of everything he's doing. And because of her brilliance, he succeeds in his mission.
Of course.
So that's how the film opens.
Right.
We establish that that she's in love with him. He takes her for granted, even though he respects her work. But soon he goes missing, and the CIA needs a spy with an unknown profile to go out into the field and solve the mission.
This is funny, right? This is a comedy.
It is a comedy.
Oh, it sounds good.
It's a delightful comedy, yeah. And so she goes out into the field, and of course, you know, she saves the world, right? It's that kind of movie. It's great fun. It has a wonderful supporting cast, including Rose Byrne, Allison Janney of The West Wing, Bobby Cannavale, and Jason Statham playing against type. So he's not the super spy here. And, of course, Jude Law, all of whom are great. So in this clip, we hear Melissa McCarthy and her sidekick friend, the British comic Miranda Hart, looking at the gadgets that are being offered to her instead of a parody of the typical Q meets James Bond scene.
Right. Patrick.
Susan.
Hey, Patrick.
Yes.
I was given specific instructions by Elaine to tailor these gadgets to you. These are not yours.
Oh.
This antifungal spray can freeze and disable any security system.
Wow, that is quite an image to be carrying all over Europe.
It's also a pepper spray.
Why not just make it look like pepper spray?
It's a pretty good idea. All right, well, next time.
Well, I can wait if you want to print up a new label.
No, I'd have to turn the printer on again. I don't really want to. Each of these are filled with chloroform.
Wow, that is an unsettling amount of hemorrhoid wipes. It makes me kind of wonder what exactly is going on back there.
I wouldn't know. I don't have that problem.
I don't have that problem.
This sounds good. You like this?
I did. I enjoyed it. And it fits nicely into this recent string of big movies featuring strong central female protagonists like Pitch Perfect 2, Mad Max Fury Road. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's great fun. It's a dumb comedy, but it's a good dumb comedy.
Now, on San Andreas, did you like this movie or did you stand there in the theater and say, whose fault is this?
Yeah, I kind of was in the latter camp.
I'm sorry.
It's a disastrous disaster film. A sort of hilariously terrible. For the first,
well, see, I kind of like terrible disaster films.
All right, well then you might like this. Although there's a lot of CG that is excessive and not that much character development. I like Dwayne Johnson, aka The Rock. I find him extremely personable. And in this movie, he plays a Los Angeles rescue pilot. Primarily rescuing people from his helicopter, though in this movie he also flies a plane. And when the big one...
So this is about the big one.
The really big one hits California. despite the warnings that Paul Giamatti, who plays a seismologist, gives to everyone, people ignore the warnings and the big one hits, devastates Los Angeles, devastates San Francisco. But all of this sort of ends up being secondary to the family drama at the center as... The Rock and his divorced wife, Carla Gugino, or almost divorced wife, go searching for their daughter, who's in a different city. So it's really this family drama.
So the San Andreas, the big one, brings them together?
It does bring them together, yes. So,
by the way, I got a question about Giamatti. Does he play like the neurotic guy who's warning people?
Well, he's not neurotic in this film.
I like him neurotic.
He's sort of calmer, but authoritative in an intellectual way. And the clip I chose, if we have time for it, is him warning the world about the big one.
Hello, Chris. I'm here with Dr. Lawrence Hayes, Executive Director for Earthquake Studies at Caltech. He and his research partner, Dr. Kim Park, have come up with a model that predicts earthquakes. They knew LA was going to get hit, but nobody listened to them. It's time now to listen. Go ahead, Doctor.
Okay, in seismology terms, what we're experiencing is what we call a swarm event. Basically, California's entire tectonic plate is shifted. People need to know that the shaking is not over, and it's not aftershocks I'm talking about. San Francisco will get hit again, and it's going to be a bigger monster this time. Our models are predicting a 9.5 or greater. It will be so big that even though it's happening here in California, you will feel it on the East Coast.
Wow.
Yeah, big trouble.
I'm kind of a sucker for these movies.
Well,
so.
The problem is that all of these big set pieces end up just not working that well and being so ludicrous that, for me anyway, I was kicked out of the film. But the first 30 minutes were the best. There's a really wonderful rescue moment, a scene where The Rock has to go into Los Angeles and literally pluck his wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, Carla Gugino, from the top of a collapsing building. And that set piece worked really well. And then the movie sort of went downhill from there.
Okay, Chris. What do we have to look forward to this summer?
Well,
otherwise,
since Paul is in the studio here and was talking about books, I want to recommend highly a film that's opening in Baltimore on June 26th called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. It's based on a best-selling novel that came out in 2012. It's a sad film because there is a dying girl at the center of it, written by Jesse Andrews, who also wrote the screenplay. But it's also an incredibly life-affirming and very funny movie. It manages to be a comedy, tragic comedy about cancer. And it works. Boy, does it work. It won the Sundance Audience Award this year, won a jury prize, and it really is, for my money, the movie to see this month. I mean, there's Jurassic World, which comes out next weekend. There's the new Pixar film, which comes out the weekend after, Inside Out. All of these are films to look forward to, but really, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl is the film to see.
Got it. June 26th. Me and Earl and A Dying Girl.
The Dying Girl.
The Dying Girl. Thank you for mentioning that, Chris, and thank you for your reviews today. Christopher Llewellyn Reed will be back when?
June 26th to talk about Jaws.
Oh, that's right. We're doing a Jaws special that day. Summer blockbuster Jaws. Okay. Because it's the 40th anniversary,
It's the 40th anniversary of the release of Jaws.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks,
Dan. Thank you, everybody. That's the first hour of Midday. Please stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up in the second hour of our show today, including some tips on backyard grilling and barbecuing. We're going to take a break now here for a little pizza from Joe Squared Pizza and thank them again for providing lunch for our guests here on Midday Friday. Please stay tuned for the news, and then we'll see you for the second hour.